You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top.
Stop to listen. You can hear their hearts beating loud. Can't keep those California Indians down.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. On today's program, In Suspension, the 31st anniversary of the EZLN uprising in Chiapas is placed on hold due to the escalation of cartel and state violence. We'll get an extensive, in-depth update, all that and more, here on American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone thu'el in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching down the mountain. Because history ain't no mystery to me.
January 1st of 2025 marks the 31st anniversary of the rise of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation on January 1st of 1994 against the colonial state of Mexico and global capitalism. On January 1st of 1994, the Mayan people's traditional homelands were recovered after the 12-day armed uprising of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation against state violence and the legacy of settler colonial oppression throughout Mexico. The EZLN's actions are concrete evidence of how Zapatismo in Chiapas has improved the living conditions of the communities based on organization, autonomy, and self-determination. Today on American Indian Airwaves, our guest for the hour explains why this year's anniversary, the 31st anniversary of the beginning of the war against Bolivia, the armed uprising of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, or the EZLN, on January 1st of 1994, and against the colonial state of Mexico and global capitalism, was placed on hold due to the escalation of cartel and state violence against the Mayan peoples throughout the region of Chiapas. Our guest for the hour is Richard Stoller Shoke, a retired professor of political science at Eastern Michigan University and a community activist involved with the School of Chiapas, which is an organization of grassroots activists and communities working to support the autonomous indigenous Zapatista communities of Chiapas in Mexico. Today on American Indian Airwaves, I'm joined by Marcus Lopez of the Barbareño Band of the Chumash Nation, who's also the co-host and executive producer of American Indian Airwaves. We begin our interview with Richard Stoller Schulk on why the 31st anniversary of the EZLN uprising was placed on hold, with a brief account of what happened back in January of 1994.
Sure. Many listeners will remember in January of 1994, the world was startled to wake up to the scenes of an indigenous rebellion in the southeast Mexican state of Chiapas. The Zapatista rebellion was mostly indigenous Maya people who were rising up in protest against really centuries of exclusion, marginalization, and repression in one of the poorest states in Mexico. Even though January 1994 was the public date of the uprising, the Zapatista rebel group had been organizing for 10 years before that, and in fact there had been peaceful marches, demands, petitions, etc., that the government had totally ignored. So this was a kind of a cry, as the Zapatistas say, of ya basta, we've had enough already, that's it. And the immediate trigger at that moment in January of 1994 was the entry into effect of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that neoliberal or global ultra-free trade model was, what the Zapatistas say, a death sentence for poor indigenous and other people in Mexico and in other places. That was the, that's a little bit of the background. Fast forward, 30 years later, January of 2024 was the 30th anniversary of the Zapatista uprising, and actually the 40th anniversary of the origins of the movement in clandestinity. And so there were commemorations of that anniversary. But now, as we move into the 31st anniversary year, January 2025, the Zapatistas had initially announced plans to similarly commemorate the anniversary of the uprising, but then they have suspended since then these celebrations because of the widespread violent presence of organized crime throughout Chiapas and indeed throughout many states in Mexico. This year, 2024, is significant in a number of other ways, too. It was also the 50th anniversary of the 1974 Indigenous Congress that was held in Chiapas, really the first of its kind, of all the various indigenous groups of the state coming together and sharing their stories, their unheard stories in the mainstream media at least. And that Indigenous Congress was convened by the late Bishop of Chiapas, Samuel Ruiz, who was much beloved by the indigenous people. This year, 2024, would have also been the 100th birthday of Samuel Ruiz, so the Diocese of San Cristobal in Chiapas, where he presided, is commemorating what they're calling a jubilee year. So many anniversaries, many of them bittersweet.
Richard, the area of Mexico, in itself, is really a misunderstood nation, as you will, the modern nation state, but Mexico is the background of it, just like a North America continent, you might say, of the United States of America, is misunderstood in the territory of what Native people say, stolen land and the treaties not being honored, and so on and so forth, that we've discussed here at American Indian Airways numerously. But within Mexico, it's not just a recent phenomena of recent times, but yet, you know, for example, the Cass War of 1869, the Ladino Massacre, so-called, the Mexican Revolution of the Tocil, when they expressed in 1914 to 1940, the when we stopped being crushed, the Tocil, and the resurgence of organizing and the meticulous organizing and cultural revolution that Chiapas and neighboring areas and in native villages, you might say, and nations, if you will, have organized. Why don't you give us a lesson of Chiapas and before the Zapatistas, as you might say, was a realm of the role of, especially we want to get to later on, but the role of the church and the role of this priest that was really since 1914 been instrumental in protection, ironically, of the villagers in many forms. Talk about that. Unpack that for us.
Sure. Lots of good questions and points that you're making there, Marcus. Mexico is indeed a very misunderstood country in many ways. And the post-colonial, really it's kind of an ongoing neo-colonial government in Mexico, has put forward the myth that it's all one happy sort of melting pot country under the framework of a kind of mestizo assimilationism, that is, people of indigenous and European background supposedly coming together in one harmonious blend. Well, in fact, as you point out, there's a long history of indigenous uprisings, of continued indigenous demands for recognition of their ongoing existence and specific identities. So across Mexico, about 14% of the population, roughly, identify as indigenous, and Chiapas actually has a much higher percentage. It's one of several states in the south, in particular, with very high percentages of indigenous population. So in that sense, this kind of generic vision that Mexico is all one people is a gross oversimplification. It's also a country that's misunderstood politically. In the United States, we are sold the myth that Mexico is a democracy, they have regular elections, but of course there's more to democracy than having regular elections. Mexico has been described as a perfect dictatorship because of the many elements of authoritarian control, despite having regular elections and some of the outward appearances of democracy. So, for instance, this year there was another election in Mexico. The new president, Mexico's first woman president, won in a landslide, and so that is presented as an indication that somehow Mexico is this shining example of democracy, and as we'll no doubt talk about later on in this conversation, it's a lot more complicated than that. The church has had a very important role in Mexico, the Catholic Church in particular. There are other churches, and particularly the Protestant and evangelical churches, whose influence is growing in many of the poor parts of the country, like Chiapas. But the Catholic Church, if we go back to the 16th century, the first bishop of Chiapas was a Dominican friar, Bartolome de las Casas, who started to write letters back to the Catholic majesties in Spain, to the king and queen, saying, you know, what's being done in your name here doesn't look very religious, the slaughter of indigenous people and the mistreatment and this, you know, if they actually have souls, then this would be a really sinful act to be doing this, and you've got to do something about it. And those collected letters have been published. You can find them in any library under the title of A Brief History of the Destruction of the Indies. And to kind of keep him quiet, the governing authorities of the colonial era named the bishop Protector of the Indians. They gave him that honorific title, but he continued to be outspoken. In some ways, he was sort of foreshadowing what would emerge in many parts of Latin America in the mid to late 20th century, known as liberation theology, that is, reinterpreting theology in a way that gives priority, preferential focus on the needs and concerns of the poor and the marginalized. And an offshoot of that liberation theology is what is sometimes referred to as Indian theology. The indigenous people, in many cases, as dispossessed and oppressed peoples, embraced elements of this sort of dissonant current. So there's always been not just one church, but sort of the official hierarchical top-down colonial church, and then the dissonant faction of the church that gives priority focus on the poor and the marginalized. So a complicated country.
Yes. Now, Richard, what about the importance of the late Bishop Samuel Ruiz with his 100th birthday? What did they even mention that for?
Yeah, Samuel Ruiz was as I mentioned, the Bishop of Chiapas at the time of the Zapatista uprising, and he was eventually very much in this mold of liberation theology or Indian theology when he first was appointed and went to become the Bishop of the Diocese of San Cristobal de las Casas. And interestingly, that Las Casas was named after Bartolomé de las Casas from the 16th century, protector of the Indians. So the name of the diocese, the name of the tourist town of San Cristobal de las Casas, reflects that long history. So when Samuel Ruiz was first appointed as the bishop in the late 20th century, he was a relatively apolitical person, sort of in the mold of Oscar Romero in El Salvador, who many know as being a leading figure in the liberation theology movement before he was assassinated in 1980. So Samuel Ruiz in Chiapas also underwent this transformation through his contact with the indigenous people. He began to go out to the communities, ride out on a burro to the most remote areas to learn indigenous languages, to learn about the culture. So he was not the first nor the last to undergo this kind of revelatory transformation. The Zapatistas, somewhat similarly, many of them, when they initially arrived in Chiapas, the nucleus of sort of rebel organizing, were not necessarily indigenous. They were from other regions of the country, and they initially didn't quite understand the reality of the poor indigenous peoples of Chiapas. And it took that decade of wandering in the wilderness, you might say, before the Zapatista uprising, for them to go through this kind of transformation and understand the perspective and concerns of indigenous people. So Samuel Ruiz was a natural choice to be a mediator when the Zapatista rebellion broke out, because he had the confidence of the indigenous population. He believed in the priority concern for the poor.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with retired Professor Richard Stoller Schulk and community activist of the School of Chiapas on why the 31st anniversary of the Zapatista National Liberation Army was suspended this year due to the escalation of cartel violence and more. And now back to the interview.
But the negotiation never really produced any meaningful results. The government's initial response to the Zapatista uprising was to send in the military with guns blazing. And there was such an outcry from Mexican civil society from all across the country, not just indigenous people in Chiapas, but an outcry saying you have to at least talk, you have to see what the root concerns are that led to this uprising. And so that led to, in short order, a ceasefire and a process of negotiation. But then negotiation broke down because, as we know, colonial governments often promise anything and then violate their promises to native peoples, and that there's a long history of that. And that's pretty much what happened in the case of Mexico, too. Zapatistas, though, continued to develop their autonomy movement after the uprising. They said, okay, we don't recognize the legitimacy of this bad government, as they call it, so we're going to create our own government at the local level in our communities. We'll keep
now,
talking
Richard,
here as long as it makes sense. Yes.
Yeah, Rich, the Declaration of Principles, as I read, the Zapatista Front and National Liberation, it's a Mexico political organization present throughout the entire country that uses civil and nonviolent forms of struggle to realize in our country a free, just, democratic, and participatory society open to all currents of thought, plural in its cultural and ethnic composition, inclusive in regards to every type of minority and its economic and social order. And yeah. So from this goal, the FZLN is based on the ethnic, cultural, and historical roots that form the Mexican nation. And it goes on. Second point says the Zapatista Front of National Liberation declares self-independent ideological, political, economically, from political parties, churches, the Mexican state, and other states in the world. That in itself, and it goes on, but that in itself, the Zapatistas, we call that the abbreviation of the Zapatistas Front of National Liberation, was unique in such what you stated about the history of unique because it did voice out. Now, that being said, how is the election of the Morena Party reelected by a landslide of Claudia Sheinbaum replaces AMLO? How does that affect Mexico? Talk about that for our listeners, about the relationship with that election process and the history of Mexico with violent, the political violence of this election.
Yes, those documents that you were quoting from reflect, I think, a core idea of the Zapatista movement, which is radical democracy, as opposed to the kind of sham procedural political party dominated and manipulated version. So the Zapatistas
are... Yeah, Rich, they were talking about, especially, and I want to interrupt you, but yes, you mentioned that many times I talked to you that educated me, and that is democracy from below.
Exactly, yeah. So that's the ethos of the Zapatista movement. Now, just a clarification, the Zapatista Front for National Liberation was a temporary organization, doesn't exist anymore, hasn't for a while. It was one of the civil society groups in support of the Zapatista movement. But that's part of the beauty of Zapatismo, that it was not intended to tell everyone what to do or how to organize, but it was intended as a wake-up call to encourage everyone to organize for radical democracy in their own spaces. And from all of those spaces, and from below, or as the Zapatistas like to say, from below and to the left, to transform the country. So this is very different from the electoral model. So Mexico just had, as I mentioned, these elections in June of this year, and the Morena Party, which the outgoing president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO as he's known, he ended his term. There's a non-reelectable six-year term in Mexican presidential politics. And his same party, the Morena Party, swept the elections at all levels, including the presidency, with Claudia Sheinbaum, the former mayor of Mexico City, becoming the new incoming president. But really what this is doing is it's cementing a kind of a monopoly of power by one party. It's not very different from the 71-year monopoly by the old PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, that by hook or by crook managed to marginalize and sidetrack all other opposition parties. So even though there's the illusion of party competition, it's far from democracy. So this election that just happened in June, just a couple of examples of how distant it is from real meaningful democracy, the governor-elect of the state of Chiapas, Eduardo Ramírez Aguilar, has ties to organized narco groups, drug cartels, and to he was also ties to paramilitary groups that exert political violence on behalf of these criminal syndicates. He's a powerful man. He was the former president of the federal Senate, one of the movers and shakers behind the scenes in Mexican politics. So regardless of who is formally elected, behind the scenes there are these kind of hidden dark powers. This election was the most violent election of any in Mexican history. There were 749 victims of political violence during the electoral campaign period, including 231 people assassinated, candidates assassinated, which really reflects how these shadowy criminal organizations have infiltrated electoral politics at all levels. The outgoing administration of AMLO and the incoming administration of Sheinbaum, both from the Morena Party, pushed through a series of constitutional reforms, including judicial reforms, changing the nature of the judiciary so that now, with these reforms, all levels of the judiciary, from the local judges all the way up to and including the Supreme Court, will be required to stand for election, which the Morena Party announced with great fanfare as supposedly increasing democratic input. But really what it means is that the party with a monopoly of power now has no checks and balances from the judicial branch on its exercise of power. And it also means that the criminal organizations who have infiltrated local electoral politics now can get their hands on the judiciary as well and make sure that they continue to enjoy impunity for this atmosphere of violence. So this is not exactly what we think of when we hear the word democracy, and certainly the Zapatistas are not satisfied with that label of democracy for the Mexican political system.
Now, Richard, once you talk about the Indigenous National Congress and the EZLN, and particularly the recognize the Indian rights to stop the war, the Fifth Declaration on July 19, 1998, the Indians, an often object of, and they ask for the representation, gratitude, honor, recognition, inclusion, respect, national opinion, and about the Indian debt weighs heavily within Mexico. Now, I use the word Indian in relation to Indigenous peoples, First Nations, or whatever, with the column within Mexico that talk about that for the National Indigenous Congress and this declaration, if you will, the memory of the many activities of the Zapatistas and their approach. It's many faceted approach. You didn't mention the world tour. You didn't mention the declarations, many of them. Why don't you highlight that for our listeners?
Sure. The Zapatista, this inclusionary version of democracy that we were talking about, goes far beyond Chiapas and the specific participants in the Zapatista uprising. The indirect effects have been tremendous on Mexico, the kind of demonstration effect of what a real democracy could mean. So one example of that is that 2 years after the Zapatista uprising of 1994, the 60-plus indigenous groups from all over Mexico, of whom maybe there are 8 indigenous groups are primarily located in Chiapas, but all the other indigenous people all across the country came together for the first time ever to form the National Indigenous Congress, CNI for its initials in Spanish. And that National Indigenous Congress was, you know, really a direct inspiration from the Zapatista uprising. The Zapatistas don't control it, didn't create it, but it was one of those kind of indirect effects of opening up the concept of politics and political participation to be much more inclusionary. In the last election in 2018, last presidential election, when AMLO won also in a landslide, the Zapatistas teamed up with the National Indigenous Congress and ran a kind of symbolic candidate, an indigenous woman who whose nickname was Marichuy, Maria de Jesus Patricio Martinez, and she was a Nahua indigenous woman from another part of Mexico, not from from Chiapas. And the whole point of her candidacy was not to win elections, because that's not the vision of democracy that the Zapatistas and that other indigenous groups in Mexico have, but to call attention to all the issues that don't get reported in mainstream politics and that don't get discussed by the candidates who are just seeking office for their own gain and for their own powerful groups. So also in the context of that electoral period, the National Indigenous Congress and the Zapatistas, besides teaming up to support this symbolic candidacy slash non-candidacy at the presidential level, they also convened a series of assemblies of all the indigenous groups throughout the country to have people chosen by each indigenous community to represent a kind of constituent assembly of indigenous peoples and to create the Indigenous Council of Government. So a kind of parallel government at the national level for Mexico. Again, it's now Rich, it's symbolic but important. Yes.
Now, Rich, I don't want to interrupt you, but I think it's a so important point because of the fact that especially the spirit of Ariana and women within this movement, it was many of the communities got together and the centrality of women within this electoral process. Minashui and her, she's a practice with her, how should I say it, medicine and culture and traditions heavily involved within that. And that's why they chose her in order to represent the women and the culture of Mexico within that process. So talk about that for a second. I don't want to interrupt you, but there's many of the meetings within her travel throughout Mexico that galvanized the centrality of women within this whole discussion. Talk about that for us.
Yes, that's an excellent point. So all excluded people have found space within this broader kind of vision of participatory democracy, and Marichuy is an example of that, and her being a strong indigenous woman. And at the same time, she, by profession, by occupation, vocation, she is an indigenous healer. And many indigenous visions of healing are kind of integral healing. So healing all the ills of the body politic, for example, as well as the individual physical harms that, you know, the human body may experience. So this healing view has also drawn a lot of women to be in the forefront of struggles against the mega projects, the extractivist industries that are destroying Mother Earth in Mexico and many other parts of the region. So that was also a part of her kind of mobilizing appeal and part of the resistance against the dominant powers that are masquerading as an electoral democracy. So I think that all of those things are important to recognize. Also, the Zapatistas have specifically opened up spaces in their communities and their autonomy project for much greater participation by women. So while their goal is to have equity, they're moving in that direction. We see in the Zapatista governing councils and the community chosen education promoters and health promoters in Zapatista communities, more and more women finding empowerment in those roles. The Zapatistas have convened women's meetings and assemblies in their territories, and women from all over the world come and meet and exchange experiences with the indigenous women in the communities. So these are all important, significant changes that don't get registered in the narrow view of electoral politics.
Now, Rich, even Cornel Fabiana, she numerously went down there, especially women conferences. They didn't allow any men in the conferences. You know, I mention that because it's significant. Not only, we're not talking about equality, we're talking about the massive participation and centrality, the central role that the Native culture places within the Mother Earth, the corn culture, the corn, and all that's a manifestation of.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with retired Professor Richard Stoller Schulk and community activists of the School of Chiapas on why the 31st anniversary of the Zapatista National Liberation Army was suspended this year due to the escalation of cartel violence and more. And now back to the interview.
And I use the word centrality, and I think the listeners need to understand it's not only central, but it's central. And so like what Fabiana said, in these conferences of women, they didn't allow any men. And I thought that was refreshing in the sense that it took a different, you would never see that in North America. You would never see that a lot of the conferences that here exist here. And I thought that was the EZLN. And as Zapatistas, we're noted for that. Larry.
Thank you, Marcus. Richard, you touched on talking about Mother Earth and the extractive industry. And, you know, in talking about the rise of the EZLN and acknowledgement of the anniversary coming up in January of 2025, walk our listeners back to kind of pre-1994, and I'm thinking of 1992, right, when both the Mexican Constitution and in secondary laws, we saw reform of Mexico's Constitution, Article 27, followed by the reform in agrarian laws and the creation of a mining law that's been modified over the years. And talk about that in relationship to extractive mining and how that is central, another thread or fiber, if you will, is such central to the struggle for indigenous peoples throughout Chiapas.
Sure. Since the time of the Mexican Revolution in the early 20th century, the revolutionaries had in mind a more communal version of sharing and using and working the land. And so that led to an agrarian reform, which was very much promoted at the time by Emiliano Zapata. He was the leader of the peasant wing of the Mexican Revolution. And that gave rise to a constitution in 1917 that provided, in Article 27 that you mentioned, that the land should have essentially a social purpose, and that landless peasants, which is almost, you know, kind of a contradiction in terms in a way, because what peasants most desire is land to be able to work self-sufficiently and in any way they choose. So landless peasants could petition the government, and the government would be required to come up with land and allow the peasants to organize communities and collectively manage these plots of land that would allow them to continue their existence as peasants. And the same thing for indigenous people, and there's some overlap in those two categories, who often have communal traditions and understandings of relationships with the land. So toward the end of that of the 20th century, all that began to be torn apart with the neoliberal or global free market model of making everything a commodity and making everything about individual accumulation of profit. So that 1992 reform of Article 27 basically ended the right of peasant communities to petition for land, and in fact took away those ejidos, those collective lands. It took away their protections so that they could be broken up and put onto the market for individual sale and bought by individuals or corporations or investors, etc. So that's part of this devastating trend, but it's devastating not only in an economic sense for peasant and indigenous communities, but also in a kind of identity sense for people who derive their identity from that communality. So the mining law reforms, similarly, are really kind of making the mining companies now the priorities for having rights of access to land and water, as opposed to, say, peasant communities, indigenous communities, others who would have priority rights and a say over the use of those lands and resources. So this is a kind of, you know, complete reversal. Ironically, the Mexican governments have continued to try to present the image of being a continuation of the Mexican Revolution, even as they're turning around 180 degrees and moving entirely in an opposite direction. So mining and other extractive industries, oil and other industries of the sort, not only concentrate income and wealth, but they have this devastating environmental impact under international law. There's a requirement that indigenous communities be consulted in a meaningful way. The phrase is free, prior, and informed consent before such investment projects can be carried out in historical indigenous territories. But the government has run ramshot over those processes of consent and made a mockery of them. So these mega projects have a devastating impact, and those who are trying to preserve their communities and their relationship to the land and their historic stewardship of resources are finding that they are criminalized, displaced from their lands. Indigenous people are being violently displaced with no real consultation, and that there's violent repression of any indigenous protests, resistance against these mega projects. And that violent repression, some of it comes from the official instances of the state, the police at different levels, the military, and now the new National Guard that was created under the AMLO administration. So new repressive apparatuses popping up all the time officially, and then unofficially, paramilitary groups and criminal organizations that more and more are vying for territorial control. So this turn toward extractive industry has been devastating for poor indigenous peasant communities and others who are trying to preserve a vision of life that's very different from the vision of profit maximization for global corporations.
Now, Rich, we see that the AMLO government and now the Morena government, which is an extension of it, has been at least 1,600 projects of mega projects to be carried out within the whole Yucatan and the whole Chiapas, Guerrero, and other states within that in the southeast of Mexico. And we can see that this has an impact not only on the people, but the current climate crisis and the conditions of the crisis and mineral extractions and labor and all that goes with it. I don't see ILO come into the picture as far as defending the indigenous peoples now. That being said, why don't you, like as the saying goes, when Mexico catches the cold, United States sniffles, and maybe it's the other way around. But the relationship with these 1,600 or more so, and the Melicadoras, Mexico being the largest city in the world, the most polluted city in the world, outside maybe of Tokyo. But that being said, what's the relationship where you have reading years and years and years of NACBA magazine, the relationship within the United States of America and Mexico as a country being one of its major traders within the country, and where the capital is easily being traded and allowed in this country, but the labor is not? Talk about the relationship with the economy of Mexico and the economy of the United States of America, and what the relationship is, especially now with this mega project, but also with a lot of minerals, lithium, et cetera, et cetera. Mexico is rich, one of the richest countries, and yet one of the poorest physical populations of the hemisphere. Talk about that for us.
Yes, this is true, not just for Mexico, but all around the world. We see this with the climate change conference that's going on in Azerbaijan right now, the Conference of Parties, where the global south, the poorer countries of the world, are saying, hey, you know, the global north, the wealthy industrialized countries, have gotten rich out of not only extracting our resources, but also dumping all the pollution on us, and then expecting the poor countries to do the cleanup and paying the cost of this global climate devastation. So it's a very unequal relationship. And really, the global capitalist interests are not specifically U.S. or Mexican or European, et cetera. There's a kind of convergence of that global capitalist class in their predatory vision of extracting resources and then foisting all the costs on the poorest and most vulnerable communities on a global scale. So that's sort of the kind of global picture of what we're seeing. The mega projects in Mexico are just soaring, and AMLO was one of the most aggressive promoters of some of these projects. I'll just mention two of the most notable or notorious ones. One, which the government has dubbed the Mayan Train, although Mayan people in many cases are outraged by that label because there's nothing Mayan about it, and that is building a kind of tourist train link between the Mayan ruins in the Yucatan Peninsula all the way down to the state of Chiapas. It's been cutting vast segments of forest, destroying cultural heritage, displacing communities. There's been little or no meaningful consultation, and in fact, increasingly violent repression of those who object. And the other major mega project that I'll mention is the Interoceanic Corridor. West of Chiapas is the state of Oaxaca, and there's a narrow isthmus called the Tehuantepec Isthmus. And the idea is to make that into a kind of global center for capitalist commerce, to build deep water ports and high speed rail and storage facilities and container facilities and capture wind energy. And it's a kind of multifaceted project, all for the enrichment of global capital. So the resources, including things like wind energy, these intangible resources, are not being used for the benefit of the local community. Quite the contrary, those communities are being suppressed. An important part of this push for extractivist industries that are opposed by local communities is the violence with which they're being pushed and imposed. So political violence is at record levels in Mexico. There was recently a report by a group called Global Witness, a non-governmental organization, that defenders of land, territory, and human rights are being targeted at unprecedented levels. There were 225 assassinations of activists in those categories just in the last 6 year period of AMLO's administration, and that leaves indigenous communities in particular more vulnerable if the defenders of rights, land, and territory, et cetera, are being assassinated. Overall, in Mexico, the last presidential term saw the highest level of homicides ever of any presidency in Mexican history, 151,000 during AMLO's term, with 30,000 people killed just in the last year alone. And an entire stretch of the Guatemalan border, Mexico's southern border — we always hear about the U.S. southern border and Mexico's northern border, but we don't hear about the other border — but a whole stretch of that border is now largely under control of competing criminal organizations, essentially holding local communities hostage. In fact, there are people, many of them indigenous people living in that border region, who are now fleeing as refugees to Guatemala. And you know things are bad if you flee to Guatemala for refuge. All of this is closely linked to the desire of the criminal organizations and the government to prioritize the needs of global capital at the expense of local communities, and even to use unprecedented levels of violence to clear the territory for their own private profit.
Rich, we keep mentioning NAFTA back in 1994, but NAFTA was replaced by the United States-Mexico-Canadian Agreement that I believe went into effect in 2020. I was wondering, talk about what its impact is, because it replaced NAFTA. So everything that you've been sharing with us, is that accelerating everything? So what's the impact that this agreement that replaces NAFTA is having?
Yes, I would say it's a continuation. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is a continuation of NAFTA. Some things were tweaked, a few things just updated to account for areas like intellectual property, et cetera, that weren't as prominent features of the negotiations in the earlier agreement, but it's the same logic. There were a few things in the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the successor agreement, that were taking into account some of the concerns and critiques, particularly from organized labor, to introduce some supposedly greater protections for labor rights, but we'll see in the implementation whether that winds up having any meaning. So basically, it's a continuation, I would say, of the same model, giving largely free rein to global capital, to the largest corporations. As I think both of you pointed out, there's a certain irony in allowing free movement of goods and capital, but not allowing free movement of labor. So it's as though they want to extract the labor power from the human beings who happen to be attached to it and dehumanize and repress the actual human beings and give full rights to these corporate entities and treat them as though they are people.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with retired Professor Richard Stoller Schulk and community activists of the School of Chiapas on why the 31st anniversary of the Zapatista National Liberation Army was suspended this year due to the escalation of cartel violence and more. And now back to the interview.
So we see that logic in different ways in the United States as well, with the Supreme Court ruling saying that corporations are people for purposes of speech and buying their way into political influence, etc. It's a dangerous model. It's not just an economic model. It's also a kind of comprehensive political and social model of control.
Rich, why don't you talk about now the Zapatistas and about the announcement of restructuring of their organization of autonomy. Now, the system of juntas and municipal zones has resulted in an overtly hierarchical structure, and there were abolished the juntas and inverting the pyramid of power to the communities have much decision-making power at the base. Talk about that.
Sure. I think this set of kind of internal reforms that the Zapatistas announced in the last few months of last year are a good illustration of what we were talking about before, the radical democracy model of continuing to put the power at the grassroots level, at the bottom, and have it be a bottom-up movement. So the Zapatistas did their best in their structuring of their territories to empower the grassroots, particularly at the community level. And we're talking in their territories of typically villages of maybe 50 to a few hundred people. With village assemblies, which everyone participates, they select people to carry out different unpaid functions. The whole community then pitches in to support those community members. So that's a very different model of government from the kind of bureaucratic or professionalized government that that we often think of when we think of governments. But even with that kind of radical restructuring of government, the Zapatistas, in reflecting self-critically on their own movement and their own autonomy process, saw that despite their best intentions, when you send a representative, even if it's a rotating representative on a short-term basis with accountability protections and so forth, send them off to represent a community or a group of communities at some higher level, then they're away from their community. They immediately start to become a little bit distanced from the grassroots needs. The infrastructure of communication and transportation is not the greatest in that region. And there's a human tendency, too, when you rise to sort of lose sight of where you came from. So I think this is part of the internal thinking that the Zapatistas revealed for us in their explanation of their restructuring to further decentralize their movement. So rather than having good governance boards at the kind of regional level within the Zapatista territories, the main unit of government would be the community government. And then if groups of communities wanted to get together and form a collective of communities, they could do that. If they wanted to periodically call an assembly of several collectives of communities in the region, they could do that. But really, it was up to the communities themselves to design and to continually redesign their own form of government. So I think that's a particularly radical, even more radical than the original Zapatista vision of structuring self-governance. And then the other component of this restructuring that they announced at the end of last year was abolishing property. When the Zapatistas rose up in 94, many of the Zapatistas occupied, or recovered as they prefer to call it, lands that had been usurped by wealthy ranchers and estate owners who had typically abused the indigenous population who worked on those estates. So the Zapatistas recovered those lands and put them to work, partly for family subsistence, which was the tradition in indigenous communities, but partly also part of the lands were always set aside in each recovery for collective use, to create a collective in which the members of the community would decide the rotating labor assignments, and they would have village assemblies to decide how they were going to use the proceeds when the crop was sold at the end of the year, whether they should improve the schoolhouse or build some other facility for drinking water, etc. So what they're doing now is they're abolishing the notion of property, the individual property, as well as even the collective property that they had created. And instead, they're saying, okay, whoever uses the land has the right to that land. This was sort of the remembering the old slogan of Zapata in the time of the revolution, the land for those who work it. And they also said that even non-Zapatistas, if they were interested in sharing, participating in some way, that they were welcome to have a discussion with the Zapatista communities, and whatever agreement they came to at the local level, that would be the agreement for the use of the land, but nobody would own it. So that, again, is pretty radical, abolishing property in all of its forms and creating what they call non-property, or, you know, usage, customary usage rights in these lands. And you might say that in part that was a defensive measure, because both of these aspects, the property reforms and the governance reforms, because the powers that want to dislodge the Zapatistas and dislodge indigenous communities and take over those lands for mega projects and other profitable enterprises, those powers feel threatened by the presence of groups like the Zapatistas. And the government has long used paramilitaries and other violent shock troops to invade Zapatista communities, to try to take the land that the Zapatistas had recovered. And so the Zapatistas, in kind of a defensive measure, you might say, are now saying, well, if you're interested in that land, come talk to us and let's figure out, you know, one indigenous community to another, how we can share it, rather than let the government manipulate indigenous people against each other in a violent way that is destructive of everyone's community. So both very interesting, innovative, radical self-reforms within the movement. And as you point out, none of this ever makes the press, because we only hear about, you know, official government actions, and the attention is never on these radical grassroots initiatives.
Yeah, Richard, the new government entities, the Gobierno Autónomo Local, or the GAOs, are a refreshing element as we hear about it, where the communities, and not only the Zapatista communities, the Thomas communities, but their allegiance with a lot of the people that are quote unquote non-Zapatistas, and that's refreshing. Now, want to talk about the assassination of indigenous priests Marcelo Perez Perez and San Cristobal Las Casas, where on November of this year, over 10,000 indigenous people and their supporters in San Cristobal denouncing the assassination and demanding an end to the narco-political violence that is not only terrorizing the community across Chiapas, but a lot of bloodbaths. Talk about that for our listeners, please.
Sure. Earlier in our conversation, we were talking about liberation theology and about the kind of radical offshoot from the Catholic Church that particularly took hold in many parts of Latin America from the 1960s onward. That was very appealing to many indigenous people, remains appealing to many indigenous people in the state of Chiapas. And Samuel Ruiz, the former bishop, the late bishop of the Diocese of San Cristobal, was very much in that mode, and he encouraged the training of indigenous people to be deacons and priests in the church with this vision of radical empowerment and concern for the needs of the poor and people at the bottom. So this Tzotzil indigenous priest, Marcelo Perez, was one example of that movement, that trend brought up under Bishop Ruiz's liberation theology philosophy in the church in San Cristobal. And so he was from the highlands, outside of San Cristobal, from a community in the highlands, and he had his parish there, and was seeing how there was growing violence affecting the indigenous communities. A lot of times there were land conflicts that turned violent, and very often it was larger criminal organizations that were installing their people and manipulating these local level conflicts for their own power and enrichment. And so he made himself a mediator, a peace negotiator. He was very much a peace activist, trying to not fall into the trap of allowing indigenous communities to be divided and to set upon each other through violence. Well, of course, that was not to the liking of the power brokers, the bosses in those communities, much less the larger criminal organizations that recruit those power bosses, the cartels and so forth. So he had been receiving many, many death threats for a long time. And in fact, the bishop, the Diocese of San Cristobal, where his parish fell under that region, was so worried about him that they brought him back from that more remote community into the larger tourist city of San Cristobal and had him be a priest there, thinking that that might provide him some protection. He continued to get death threats. Activist groups petitioned to get the Inter-American Court of Human Rights to issue protective measures for him, requiring the Mexican government to provide police protection. But despite all that, Marcelo Perez always said that he was going to continue speaking out for justice and speaking the truth, and that that was his protection.
The moment of silence is over.
And that was Richard Stoller Schulk speaking on the suspension of the 31st anniversary of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, or the EZLNs, January 1st, 1994 uprising, where the Mayan people's traditional homelands were recovered after the 12-day armed uprising of the EZLN against the colonial state violence of Mexico and global capitalism, and why this year's anniversary was suspended due to the escalation of cartel violence throughout Chiapas, Mexico. And that concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest, Richard Stoller Schulk. A special thank you to our musical guest, Aragon Star, Kupa Aina, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California, For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
Nor the hands that hold the chains.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Want to be in the know for all things Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com for all the newest episodes and updates.
And don't forget to listen every other Friday.